books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show recorded in association with RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host, Robert Kirkwood, and on today's show, three very different authors who were all inspired by Shakespeare: Nadia Hetherington, Bernard Cornwell, and Michael Morpurgo. All coming up on today's Read On, plus we'll find some new books in the RNIB library. Michael Morpurgo, OBE, is one of Britain's best-loved writers for children, with sales of over 35 million copies. He's written over 150 books, served as the Children's Laureate, and has won many prizes. Also, as I've spoken to him about on the show before, with his wife Claire, he is the co-founder of Farms for City Children. He was knighted in 2018 for services to literature and to charity. I spoke to him about his book Tales from Shakespeare, retellings of 10 of Shakespeare's plays. And some of the retellings were dramatised by the RSC, introduced by Michael Morpurgo, and are available in the RNIB Talking Books Library.
This tale is based on The Tempest and tells the story of a powerful magician cast away on some magical island. There are lots of different ways to interpret Shakespeare's plays and characters. My tales from Shakespeare are full of ideas I've had about what I think the characters are like and how the stories should flow. But you might have very, very different ideas. And you might even want to try those out, write them down. See what you can do.
There are many ways to tell a story. And sometimes, it seems to me, there is only one person who should tell it. Especially if that person is at the heart of the story, the architect of it.
And even more especially if the whole story is so impossibly fantastical that otherwise it would be too hard to believe.
Unless the teller was there to witness it and to tell it afterwards.
Prospero was there.
He lived the story, his story.
So, let him tell it. His way.
I am Prospero.
I was born many years ago.
77 now. He's 77 now. He's coming towards the end.
As we all must.
I have lived a long and strange life. A life full of supreme joys and deep sadnesses, and full of regrets too. I know now that the mistakes we make, the wrongs and cruelties we commit, cannot be undone.
And most importantly, that truth must be told. Faults must be acknowledged.
It is time now, then, while I still can, to look back on my life, reflect on the good, the bad, and the ugly.
A clip from Michael Morpurgo's Tales from Shakespeare, available in the RNIB Talking Books Library. The retelling of Shakespeare's plays in a younger voice is not a new idea. Charles and Mary Lamb published their Tales from Shakespeare in 1807. I'll talk to Michael Morpurgo about the influence of this book in a moment, but for now, let's hear from that book. As I said, it was published in 1807, but a new version of it was recorded with a very familiar voice in 2005.
Tales from Shakespeare by Charles and Mary Lamb.
Told by Martin Jarvis and Rosalind Ayres.
Macbeth. When Duncan the Meek reigned king of Scotland, there lived a great thane or lord called Macbeth. This Macbeth was a near kinsman to the king, and in great esteem at court for his valour and conduct in the wars, an example of which he'd lately given in defeating a rebel army assisted by the troops of Norway in terrible numbers. The two Scottish generals, Macbeth and Banquo, returning victorious from this great battle, their way lay over a blasted heath, where they were stopped by the strange appearance of three figures, like women, except that they had beards, and their withered skins and wild attire made them look not like any earthly creatures. Macbeth first addressed them, when they, seemingly offended, laid each one her choppy finger upon her skinny lips in token of silence. And the first of them saluted Macbeth with the title of Thane of Glamis.
Martin Jarvis and Rosalind Ayres reading from Lamb's Tales from Shakespeare, available in the RNIB Talking Books Library. When I spoke to Michael Morpurgo, I asked him if we had Charles and Mary Lamb to thank for his new book.
We have, absolutely. Charles and Mary Lamb, who wrote it, I don't know, near 200 years ago. These Tales of Shakespeare, which I grew up on. Benedict Cumberbatch Groton, he wrote the introduction to my book. And I think it was because I became fond of Shakespeare with those two storytellers in the age of six, seven, eight, or no, I went off to the theatre inspired by those stories. So I thought, do it again now, because if you read those tales now, the language is, what's the word? It's antique. And young people would find that quite difficult. So do it again, Michael, I thought. Do it again. Not better, it's not better, but it's a different way and it's in the language of today.
This tale is based on The Taming of the Shrew, which is a play. It's about families, it's about love, and it's about relationships. There are lots of different ways always to interpret Shakespeare's plays and characters and stories. My tales from Shakespeare are my idea, my take on these plays and what I think the characters and the stories are like. But you'll have your own ideas. You might even want to write them down. That's what he did. Strange to think of it, but Shakespeare did sit down and just write these by hand. Maybe you could do the same thing.
This is the story of Catherine, who was famous, notorious even, all over the city of Padua for being difficult, temperamental and tempestuous, volcanic sometimes when upset, obstinate and objectionable always, just impossible.
Actually, she was just a young woman with a mind of her own and not shy of being who she was and saying how she felt.
But in those long ago days in Italy, in Padua, women were not supposed to be like that. They were supposed to be meek and mild and obedient and not to have opinions of their own.
Well, Catherine wasn't like that, and she wasn't going to be, no matter what anyone said or society dictated.
And everyone knew it.
You're retelling the tales, but Shakespeare himself was a retailer.
He was, sir, which cheat he was, and just like me. No, I mean, the truth is there are only seven stories in the world, and he pretty well picked all of them, and I've done that a lot as well. And in a sense, anyone who writes a story, you know, of course they're the great people, like Shakespeare, but we mustn't be overwhelmed by reputation. Otherwise we start treating it like a sort of gospel, you know, and treating it as if nothing else can be done around it. Actually, what we should do is act it. But if you can't act it, then tell it, you know, and that's all I did.
If you do meet him in another life, Jenk would be annoyed.
No, he wouldn't. He'd say, you're a copycat. And she's what he was. That's all right. No, I mean, I tell you what the other thing is. The other thing is that the problem with Shakespeare is that people are terribly serious about it, you know. And it's not the hallowed text. No? This is a man of flesh and blood who wrote about flesh and blood people then. And flesh and blood people are roughly the same now. We wear different costumes in a different society, but the same stuff goes on. And it's relevant, 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 and that's why I thought it was worth doing. I think, actually, I don't know, but the kind of human being I imagine he was, I would think he'd say, well, it's really good because I want people to see my plays, and I want all the people to see my plays, and he believed in that. You know, I mean, he ran theatres where people went in really cheaply, the groundlings, and they did the, if you like, they provided quite a lot of the audience reaction, which they loved. So he would have thought, no, yeah, everyone should have this. And anyway, it's our right. It's our cultural right to know Shakespeare. And one of the problems of, I won't speak of Scotland, but I will speak of England, is we have a very divided society educationally. We have those people who go to the theatre, who read books, go to libraries, and we have an awful lot who don't. And the great thing, I think, if we can do it in our schools and our libraries and everywhere, is to reach out to those people who don't necessarily come to this sort of thing easily. most people, whether they're literary or not in their background, love a good story, you know? And that's what I try to do, tell a good story. And then they think, oh, Shakespeare's quite fun. Shakespeare's quite interesting. Cool, even, you know? And if you look at the front cover of that book, it's cool. You know, that is a really cool writer having a really interesting look at you and saying, you know, enjoy this. And if you don't enjoy it, I don't care. You know, it's that sort of look in his face, which is great.
Talking of the cover, there's a link to your farm.
There is. Wonderful man who wrote it, I met. He's absolutely incredible. He's huge. And he stood up at some talk I was giving and said, I don't want to ask a question, sir. And I thought it was a bit strange. He said, but when I was 8, I came to your farm. And I worked on the farm for a week, like all the kids did, and he loved it. And I was really moved, because to meet someone all these years later who's gone off and done something remarkable, become this first-rate illustrator, it was a joy to meet him, a real joy to meet him. So it's completely appropriate that he's doing the cover. And he also did the inside illustrations to Macbeth as well, which I know people in Scotland will appreciate.
Now, you've got 10 different illustrators illustrating 10 different stories, and the audiobook carries that on. You've got 10 different actors reading the stories. Did you have any choice in the narrators of the book?
No, it was one that, it's just such a happy accident. There's so much about this book that's a happy accident. It sounds awful. It's also an unhappy accident. I wouldn't have written it if the pandemic hadn't happened. I wouldn't have been searching for a project that I would, that I wanted to find something that would be occupying to my head and emotionally and intellectually as long as possible. And I chose this. I lost myself in this project. A year went by. I hardly noticed the pandemic. And I sort of feel that that kind of immersion was very, very good for me.
She was known everywhere as the Shrew. Not that shrews are like this at all.
It's just what a woman is called who had a mind of her own and was thought to be rather feisty, sharp-tongued and argumentative, was called in those days.
Her father, Baptista was his name, was well known in the city. And a wealthy man. He had two daughters, Catherine and Bianca, and the time had come to find suitable husbands for both his daughters. But he had a problem. All the eligible young men who came calling at the house were immediately attracted to Bianca, because she was gentle and sweet and pretty.
And, most importantly, compliant.
She would do what she was told. She was just the kind of woman most of these young men were looking to marry. Catherine, the shrew, had this fearsome reputation. She might be beautiful, but she terrified every young man who came to the house. So they all steered well clear of her. None of them wanted a nightmare of a wife like her.
The Royal Shakespeare Theatre in Stratford heard about the project and said, wouldn't it be great if our actors, who are doing nothing because it's the pandemic, could get on the stage and, well, they'd be involved in the editing of it too. They went back and forth from Stratford to my house and Stratford to my house, and all the time they were editing and with the story with me and honing it, refining it, until they were happy to get up on stage. And then, of course, they did it. It was the only thing, of course, they did during there were no live action theatres going on. So I think they were very pleased to have the work and to engage with it. And I was very pleased to have the people that Shakespeare would have worked on his plays with, you know, and there they were doing it and doing it in the very place where he was born and indeed where he's buried.
Well, being an audio version means it's accessible to people for whatever reason can't access print, and you yourself have narrated books. Is that important to you?
Yeah, it's very important. I mean, I love telling stories, telling them loud, you know. I had a bit of a problem when I was a young person with print on the page. I don't know if I was dyslexic. The word wasn't around then. People didn't say anything about it, but I found reading very difficult, particularly when words were closely printed and quite small and there were lots of lines on the page. I would find that very difficult. So I sort of steered away, I think, from the print. And I love my mother reading to me. I love my grandmother reading to me. My aunt is reading to me. And the sad thing is that a lot of children get that, and then they go to school, and all of a sudden books become something that you study and you have a comprehension about it, and people start using it as text for punctuation and for grammar, and before you know it, they've taken the heart out of it. And I'm very much against that kind of thing, because I think stories are for storytelling. If you've got to write them down, but they're finally their stories for telling.
And finally, recommend one good audiobook for us. What story should be told out loud?
Well, I mentioned another book, which I think at the present moment is the most important book that's been written. Very few people know about it, but it's a book that I love, but it just happens to be hugely important now. There's a book by a man called Jean Giono called The Man Who Planted Trees, a French book written way back in the 1930s. It's about an old shepherd who goes up into the mountains each day with his sheep. But he doesn't just do that, he takes a bag of acorns and he starts planting it and planting it. It's a book which occupies 30, 40 years, and in that time he creates a forest. And with the forest, of course, comes birds, and with the forest comes water. It's about the renewing of the land. It's a hugely important book, and it's very beautifully written, so the telling of it aloud, or reading it aloud, is something I really love to do. It's a book I really want everyone to read. The Man Who Planted Trees. Read it!
About 40 years ago, I went on a long hike through hills absolutely unknown to tourists in that very old region where the Alps penetrate into Provence. This region is bounded to the southeast and south by the middle course of the Durance between Sisteron and Mirabeau, to the north by the upper course of the Drôme from its source down to Die, to the west by the plains of Comtat-Venessin, and the outskirts of Mont Ventoux. It includes all the northern part of the département of Basses Alpes, the south of Drôme, and a little enclave of Vaucluse. At the time I undertook my long walk through this deserted region, it consisted of barren and monotonous lands at about 1,200 to 1,300 metres above sea level. Nothing grew there except wild lavender. I was crossing this country at its widest part, and after walking for 3 days, I found myself in the most complete desolation. I was camped next to the skeleton of an abandoned village. I had used the last of my water the day before, and I needed to find more. Even though they were in ruins, these houses, all huddled together and looking like an old wasp's nest, made me think that there must at one time have been a spring or a well there. There was indeed a spring, but it was dry. The 5 or 6 roofless houses, ravaged by sun and wind, and the small chapel with its tumble-down belfry, were arrayed like the houses and chapels of living villages, but all life had disappeared.
That's Malk Williams, reading from The Man Who Planted Trees by Jean Giono, available from RNIB Talking Books, and it runs for a mighty 28 minutes. Also in the RNIB library is Charles and Mary Lamb's Tales from Shakespeare and Michael Morpurgo's Tales from Shakespeare. In fact, a search for Michael Morpurgo in the RNIB library brings up 13 pages of results, so there are many of his books available. For more information, head to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
You're listening to a special Read On, where we feature some authors who were inspired by Shakespeare. Still to come, Nadia Hetherington talks about Sycorax, and in a moment, Bernard Cornwell will talk about Fools and Mortals. But first, let's take a visit to the RNIB Talking Books Library to find 2 new biographical books. Please note the second book in this collection does contain some scenes that some listeners may find disturbing.
Thanks to the kind donations from many of UK's audio publishers, it can be hard to keep up with all the great new books entering the Talking Books Library. So here are 2 new gems. 85 Not Out by Ted Dexter.
For those of us old enough to have seen a bit of the 1960s, it was a fun and liberal time. A time of optimistic deregulation, and one in which heroes emerged alongside the popular culture that inspired them. You were for the Beatles, or the Stones, or both. James Bond, of course. The Cambridge Footlights, Gene Shrimpton, Twiggy and the Miniskirts, Muhammad Ali, Bobby Moore and George Best. Ted Dexter, and Jon Snow. Well, I was. It was a wonderful time to arrive on the planet and begin the circle of life. Much of this movement was about rebellion, revolution even, in response to the age of austerity. After the long and mainly drab post-war years, the young simply broke free and changed pretty much everything they could get their hands on. Music and fashion led the way, leaving sports establishment to stutter in their wake. Only a few precious players could transcend the inertia, using both their talent and expression to delight the crowds and influence the young. Cricket was my thing. Dexter and Snow were the wind beneath my wings.
A ferociously powerful and debonair cricketer who captained England in 1961-62, then who latterly became England's chairman of selectors from 1989-1993, and then president of the MCC, Ted Dexter was a classical hard-hitting batsman and right-arm swing bowler who achieved 9 centuries and 27 fifties in 62 test matches for his country, rubbing shoulders with the likes of Fred Truman, Peter May, Colin Cowdrey, Richie Beno and Gary Sobers. Dexter recalls his life in cricket in this fascinating autobiography.
In Snow's case, there truly was rebellion against authority and the system it supported. This was not so with Ted, though his free spirit and somewhat cavalier approach to responsibility gave the impression of one determined to ruffle feathers. Not so. From the outset, he adored sport, worked harder than some might think at his books, and embraced diversions with the enthusiasm of a man who had more to do than could ever be done. In truth, Ted is a contradiction. At once a conformist, as shaped by the early years of his life at home and school, and a modernist, whose lateral thinking did much to reform the structure of English cricket during his time as chairman of selectors. Richie Beno observed that Ted's imagination and drive will be of great benefit to English cricket in years to come. Equally, I'm in no doubt that others will take the credit for it. Yes, the rebellion in Ted was to challenge conservative thinking, take risks, and invest in his life as an adventure. Both on and off the field, this has made for a terrific watch.
85 Not Out by Ted Dexter is read by Crawford Logan and runs for 14 hours, 21 minutes.
A Hymn to Life, Shame Has to Change Sides by Giselle Pellicot. This was donated by Penguin Random House.
Please note this book contains scenes that some may find disturbing.
I wanted to go home. Will you be pressing charges? Deputy Sergeant Perret asked. Yes. The word came out of my mouth sounding so meek. If he hadn't asked the question, it never would have occurred to me. I just wanted this to stop, to go home, to get back to my normal life. I signed the crime report form he held out to me as if signing a disclaimer. Then my statement. I scribbled PCT, the abbreviation of Pellicot, at the bottom of each page without reading any of it, without seeing that I had also said, yes, yes, that is me, that's my room. Those are the words that are written on the document. Those are the words the police heard me say. It's all so different from what I remember. My head was screaming, no, no, it's not me, it's not him. I don't know where I am anymore. Those words are written too. That's what I said.
The sexual assault that rocked the world, a courageous woman's rallying call for shame to change sides. For the first time, Giselle Pellicot tells her story. One November day, Giselle Pellicot was called to a local police station and life as she knew it ended. Her husband of 50 years had been caught by a supermarket guard filming up women's skirts, but on his computer was shattering evidence. For nearly a decade, he'd been secretly drugging and raping her and inviting dozens of strangers into their home to abuse her. 4 years later, he and 50 other men were put on trial, and Giselle's courage in waiving her right to anonymity made global headlines. She must change sides, she declared, giving voice and hope to millions. Her words became a rallying cry, and her decision marked a turning point in public feeling about sexual violence. For the first time, and with unwavering honesty and grace, she describes a difficult childhood, first love, her career and motherhood. It is a life in determined search of happiness, both before and after her devastating discovery. She is an ordinary person who faces extraordinary catastrophe, whose example changes the world. Ultimately, Giselle Pellico emerges with a renewed passion and reverence for living and for love. A Hymn to Life is an unforgettable testament and promise that victims have no reason to be ashamed, that even after unimaginable betrayal we can go on, and that colour will always return to life.
Laurent Perret suggested a colleague take me home. You should call someone, you mustn't be alone, he said. When I finally left the police station, Dominique must have still been there. A police officer drove my car and parked in the gravel driveway in front of the garage. He did not come inside. He left immediately in the police vehicle that had followed us to the house. I opened the front door with relief, as if coming home might erase the hours that had just passed, as if I could forget them, as I had forgotten so many things over the last few years. I'd forgotten what we'd done for my birthday only a day before. I'd forgotten saying goodbye to the children when they left. I'd forgotten I'd been to the hairdresser, even though I could see in the mirror that my hair had just been cut and coloured. I had been having more and more of these memory lapses. I dreaded them. I was afraid to drive. I was afraid to take the train. I was afraid I'd miss my station. I was afraid I was dying. But that day, I deliberately wanted to summon that emptiness into my head. I wanted to forget that I had just come home from the police station alone. Impossible.
A Hymn to Life by Giselle Pellico is read by Emma Thompson and runs for 7 hours and 25 minutes.
For more information, head to rniblibrary.com. Or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show with Robert Kirkwood.
Bernard Cornwell is a prolific author of historical fiction, including the hugely successful Sharp series. His inclusion into this episode about being inspired by Shakespeare takes us back to the Cheltenham Literature Festival, when he was on stage to talk about his book, Fools and Mortals.
I think we can say your literary journey, because everything's a journey now, started in 1980 with Sharp's Eagle, and then I think another 20 Richard Sharp novels came, and then I think 10 Last Kingdom novels about Uhtred of Bebbanburg, and then I think you've covered another 20 novels, everything from the Hundred Years' War, Arthurian England, the English and American Civil Wars. So I think we reach about 52 novels.
I've lost count.
Yeah.
And that sounds very immodest, but I really have. And it's over 50. Yeah, and the new one, Nobody Dies, and it has fairies in it.
Yes. It's the new one, by the way, is called Fools and Mortals. And it is a departure.
Yeah. Fools and Mortals is about the very first production of A Midsummer Night's Dream in 1595. And it's obviously fiction, and it's told through the eyes of a guy called Richard Shakespeare. And Shakespeare did have three brothers, Edmund, Giles, and Richard. And we know something about Giles. We know a little bit more about Edmund, who became an actor and died, and is buried in what is now Southwark Cathedral. But we know absolutely sod all about Richard. We have his birth date, we have his death date, and there's one court case in between in which he got fined 12 pence for not going to church, which I approve of. And, I mean, when you have a character like Richard Shakespeare who existed, but you know nothing whatsoever about him, it's a gift to an historical novelist. And I thought, okay, well, let's make Richard into an actor in his brother's company. That's what it's about. Nobody dies, and there are fairies in it called Moth. Oh, God, I've forgotten the name of the fairies, anyway.
But
Mustard Seed.
But there are sword fights, so be reassured.
They all had to learn to fight with swords, because in the theatres of the 1580s, 1590s, and all of this takes place in a theatre which is called the theatre. The Globe wasn't to be built for another few years, and a lot of Shakespeare's earliest plays were put on in Finsbury, not on the South Bank, in a place called the theatre, a name that has stuck. And if you didn't have a play to put on, you'd often put on a sword fight, and the audiences expected there to be sword fights. These guys were terribly good at it, and they would take lessons in sword fighting. There you go. There are sword fights. And there's a bear.
And a bear, escaped bear.
Yeah.
So it's pretty good.
Nobody dies, though.
Yeah. It's very interesting what you've done with William Shakespeare. Rather than sort of making him a kind of frustrated intellectual, you sort of painted him in a certain way.
Well, I mean, it's very difficult to write William Shakespeare. and it's really difficult to write dialogue for William Shakespeare. You can't have him forever saying, well, to be or not to be. But one of the things that fascinated me when I did the research was that a year after the events of this novel, a restraining order is put on William Shakespeare. And a guy called William Waite accused him, another guy, and two women of beating the shit out of him. And he said, I feared for my life. I mean, the Swan of Avon isn't all, gentle genius sitting there writing away. This is a man who, for whatever reason, because we don't actually know what happened in that event, we've just got the court case, he's obviously a fairly tough character.
Yeah.
And he's a professional playwright. He basically has to produce two plays a year. I mean, that is the contract. But most of the time, what he's actually involved in, he's involved in the living theatre. He's involved in the money side. He's a sharer, which means he's an owner of the company. He's involved in the production of the plays, casting the plays, putting them on, the rehearsals. I mean, it's a very, very busy, active life. And above everything, he is a professional in a brand new profession.
Now, because I'm sort of trying to develop my rather shaky theory that actually underneath all your work is this serious anti-puritanical intent. So we're going to do a bit of cod psychology now.
Oh dear.
Is it fair to say that you were a peculiar boy?
Yeah. Yeah, nothing's changed. What's your next question?
Because you grew up in a Christian fundamentalist sect called the Peculiar People.
Yeah, they labelled themselves. I didn't. My mother was called Cornwell. My first birth certificate is Bernard Cornwell. And then this was in the East End of London. And I met her 58 years later. Or should I say, I was reunited with her 58 years later. And she said, this couple came in, she said, and you were in bed with me. I was older than you in bed. And I looked at them, and they looked at me. I could see they weren't cuddly. And God, she was right. And they adopted me and changed my name to Wiggins. And they belonged to a sect called the Peculiar People. Mm. And they disapproved of everything. The list was endless. High heels, cosmetics, blondes, cinema, theatre, concerts, alcohol, tobacco. I mean, it just went on and on and on and on and on and on and on. Incredibly tedious.
I think you're related, or so you reckon, to Uhtred of Bebbanburg. Isn't he sort of a great uncle or something?
Yeah, what happened was...
back a few.
Before I met my real mother, I met my real father. Mm-hmm. And his surname was Uhtred, O-U-G-H-T-R-E-D, mm-hmm. which is an old English family. From North Yorkshire. There's still a whole lot of them in North Yorkshire. And he had a family tree, which has since checked out. Mm. And it goes back to Ida the Flame Bearer in the 7th century. And there are a whole lot of them called Uhtred. It was spelt the way I spell it in the books. So, I am descended from Uhtred of Bebbanburg, about whom we know nothing. I mean, I've made him up.
But did you sort of have a strong idea of what Uhtred would be like? I mean,
It was E.L. Doctorow who said that writing a novel is rather like driving a car with very, very dim headlights down a country road at night. And you can only see as far ahead as the headlamps show on this sort of curving country road. And I, you know, I can remember starting him off. I had no idea.
Yeah.
They emerge, I think. I don't know. Something like that.
The muse speaks to you in its mysterious way.
Yeah.
Likewise with Sharp. I mean, he's been with you for a long time. So when you started, I think, what was it, 1980, the first one
was published?
Well, that
was desperation. I mean, it really was.
Yeah.
I had fallen desperately in love and decided to give up my proper job, which was actually quite a good job, as a television producer. So I, you know, the only way that, you know, the course of true love was to run even vaguely smooth was if I went and lived in America, because Judy couldn't live here for family reasons. And the Americans, in their wisdom, denied me a work permit, a green card. And I said, don't worry, darling, I'll write a book. But I did. I mean, I'd weaned myself on Hornblower and then gone on to Ramage and all those others. And it had always struck me as odd that what people were doing for the Royal Navy, no one had done for the British Army. So I thought, right, I'm going to do Hornblower on land.
Yeah.
And I mean, the difference being Hornblower is a very nice guy and Sharp isn't. And he, I mean, you know, he's grumpy in the morning. That's the only tray I share with him. And, I mean, he worked.
Given a lot of people sort of reaching history through your characters, I mean, to what extent do you feel a responsibility to the historical record?
Oh, totally. I do. I mean, I don't want to sound too pretentious, but I do think historical novelists are the gateway to history. I mean, when I was a kid, you know, I read an historical novel and got interested in history and went and got the non-fiction history books. And again, Fools and Mortals. I don't know that I'd be driving anyone to read books on Shakespeare, but I hope I'd rather them to go and see the play. because having read the book, I think people get an idea of what's in that. Most people have. It's Midsummer Night's Dream is the most commonly performed of all Shakespeare's plays. But if you haven't seen it, you're going to love it after you've read this book. In which nobody dies and in which there are fairies. Called Mustard Seed, Cobweb, Moth, and there's one missing.
It also, to reassure you, there's plenty of you in there. So I think, relax, you can take a risk. So I'd just like to ask you to thank him by either banging your swords on your shields.
Well, thank you.
Thanks again to Bernard Cornwell, interviewed live on stage at the Chichester Festival by Robbie Millen.
This is an RNIB talking book.
Talking books mean almost everything to me, because one of my hobbies, my main hobby before I suffered from Macklin disease, was reading. For instance, I don't have television. I gave it up in 1970 because I preferred reading to watching. And now I find that talking books are everything. Without talking books, I'd be damn well lost, actually.
Talking Books on RNIB Connects Radio.
And our final author, who is inspired by Shakespeare, is Nydia Hetherington. Sycorax by Nydia Hetherington is a beautifully imagined tale of the life lived before the tempest by the great witch Sycorax, blending myth, feminism and illness. And we'll hear from Nydia about how living with a chronic condition and working in theatre inspired her own writing. The book is both written and read by Nydia Hetherington.
It is cold. The island hums. It knows I cannot sleep and tries only to soothe me. Moonlight touches my face. I lift my chin a little, bathe in the brightness, and blink. White beams reach like arms into my cave as I crouch on the smooth rock at its mouth. As always, the moon's beauty makes me gasp. Hairs rise on the back of my neck. I like the sensation. Resting heavily upon my staff, my trusty aid, still fragrant with the sap of the tree it came from, I enjoy the fresh bite of the cool night air. It will be hot when daytime comes, sweat will cling to us. As I shiver, the song of the waking island risks lulling me back into slumber, even as its scents of hibiscus, mushroom and mint make me thirst for the day and its heat. How I love the contradiction. I try to stretch, but my limbs are too stiff and ache. In truth, I am racked with pain, but no more nor less than usual. I shrug, and turning towards a snuffling, snoring mound behind me, cannot help but smile. There's no sadness here.
Sycorax is the story of the witch in William Shakespeare's The Tempest. Now, you might think, well, there is no witch in William Shakespeare's The Tempest, and you would be right, because she is not seen on stage. She is only spoken about. She's actually the mother of Caliban, who is referred to as a monster by Prospero and is Prospero's slave in The Tempest. We know very little from The Tempest about her, other than that Prospero calls her a foul witch and that she is bent almost into a hoop and that she is a blue-eyed hag from Algiers. That's all we know about her. That's all the information we have. So I have written, I have given her back her voice, and I have written her story literally from the moment of her birth to the moment she arrives on that island where The Tempest is set. So if you like, it is a prequel to The Tempest, although that sounds extremely ambitious. So that's basically what Sycorax is, and that's what she's about.
My son sleeps, spindle-limbed and chubby-faced, tucked into his bed of leaves and moss, of spider silk and crow feathers. He is safe. The moon's light pools about him, while the steady flicker of my everlasting candle, the eternal flame I brought to this place when he was but a fish in my belly, dances beside him.
And why was it important to you that Sycorax was living with a chronic illness?
So I have rheumatoid arthritis, which is, and when people hear the word rheumatoid arthritis, they think of osteoarthritis, they think, oh yeah, you've got sore joints, you're a bit worn out. But that's not what rheumatoid arthritis is. It's an autoimmune disease, very like lupus or MS. In fact, I've got a friend who has lupus who's on exactly the same medication that I'm on. And it is an illness that causes a great deal of pain, a great deal of fatigue, and it affects every part of your life. So obviously, as a writer, it's part of who I am. It's part of how I see the world. I see the world through my illness, and I'm not going to shy away from it. And I'm not going to say I'm not going to be, a lot of people say I'm not going to be defined by my illness, but I feel like I am defined by my illness just by the fact that I live with it every day. And it's noticeable to me that women throughout history, and certainly in literature and through art, women are often depicted, certainly as witches, as old hags. They're often bent. They've got gnarled hands. And to me, gnarled hands and bent backs suggest pain. I wanted to kind of look at this idea that history treats unwell women extremely unkindly. If women don't fit a certain mold, if they're not young for a start, if they're not healthy, then they have to be monstrous. And I kind of wanted to examine that through this book and through the character of Sycorax, because it's very important in The Tempest that Prospero makes sure we know how monstrous she truly is. And so that's where that springs from.
Yeah, I was in education with someone who had rheumatoid arthritis, and I ended up being first a scribe, then when she was in a wheelchair, her pusher, and eventually a very good friend of mine. So I know, not firsthand, but I know secondhand how it has its ups and downs. It can be really a disability one day and it can be all right the next day. Do you find the same thing?
This is exactly the way it is. I can wake up and feel good and feel fine. It's what we call one of the invisible disabilities. So I have days, weeks, even months, even actually, depending on how good my medications are at the time, because I do have to change my medications, unfortunately, at the moment quite often because I'm having a bit of a bad spell. But there are times when I'm quite well and I can walk down the street completely unaided. I don't look like I'm having mobility problems. My hands are fine. They don't look sore. They're not lumpy or twisted. And you'd never know. And I have good days. I have good weeks and months. And then I have bad days and bad weeks and months. And in fact, the type of rheumatoid arthritis I have, I can wake up in the morning and be racked with pain on one side of my body in certain joints and certain ligaments. And it'd be so painful that I mean, just unable to move, unable to get myself to the bathroom, to be able to feed myself with this sort of part of my body. And the next day, literally 24 hours later, it's not there. It's gone. And I feel fine again. And then that can happen over a period of a day, 2 days, 3 days, a few weeks. So these flare-ups can be extremely short, but extremely painful. And then there are the longer flare-ups too. All of this is managed through medication. And if for one reason or another, the meds stop working, which is what happens because our diseases change and move and grow as we grow. So your meds can stop working at any moment and you can get full flare up. So it's an invisible disability often, not always, often an invisible disability, and it's extremely changeable. Yeah.
Now, you talked about woman as witch, and before Shakespeare had even written The Tempest, woman as Eve had transformed into woman as witch. How are stories of magic, folklore and witchcraft, how do they inform modern feminism?
I think this is really interesting, specifically where we're at now in the 21st century. I don't know if you've noticed, but it's something that I was very impressed by whilst doing my research into Sycorax. I was really aware on the periphery of my life of young women really embracing folk magic and the name witch, and even the idea of covens, whether they be worshipping witches, i.e. have some kind of religious content, i.e. Wiccan or something like that, or non-worshipping witches, i.e. they're secular, but they're interested in nature, the idea of trees being ancient beings and the land being an ancient place, and witchcraft as something to use as a tool for well-being and communing with yourself and with your sort of real sort of deeper inner sort of as a form of meditation almost. But also, not just singularly, these young women come together as a sort of sisterhood in the way that feminists have always done since, you know, the first wave of feminism. You know, they come together as sisterhoods and they call themselves covens. And it feels like in the world that we live in at the moment, when there are so many, again, a rise of like misogynistic actors through social media specifically and all over the world, you know, with Roe v. Wade in America getting rescinded and this feeling that we're going backwards again, young women seem to be embracing the history of this kind of state-sanctioned murder of women, but taking it in a real sort of positive sort of feminist direction. And I find that incredibly powerful and moving, in fact. Yes, I've just been so impressed by it. I've found so many young women practicing as witches in this kind of way.
Quercus Audio presents A Girl Made of Air by Nydia Hetherington. Read by Natalie Peeler. World on a Wire, The Fallen Star. Ellie McVeigh, The New York Times. June 14th, 1983. Manhattan, 10:30 a.m. Transcription, tape 1 of 1. Can you tell me who you are?
I've been called the greatest funambulist who ever lived.
You smile when you say it. Don't you believe it?
Sometimes.
Pause.
Sorry, I don't like being recorded very much. I've never been good at talking. I'd rather write things down. My voice is awful, isn't it? I don't recognize it sometimes. I never should have started smoking. I mean, once you're hooked. It's a lived-in voice, I suppose.
The recording's only for me. No need to worry. And your voice is great.
That's Natalie Pella reading from A Girl Made of Air by my guest Nadia Hetherington. Now, your first book came out during lockdown. Tell us about A Girl Made of Air.
So A Girl Made of Air, as you said, it was my debut and it took me a great deal of time to write it. I did, at the age of 40, I went and did a creative writing degree. I was in theatre for many years. Then I just started writing. I lived in Paris for a long time where I created theatre. And when I came back to London, sort of that theatre world wasn't available to me anymore. So I started filling notebooks and writing prose and fiction. And it was quite a surprise to me that I'd started doing this. So I managed to get on to a degree to do a creative writing degree. And I started writing a novel and that became A Girl Made of Air. And it's based in a post-war circus and it's about a tightrope walker. Again, it's the story of an outsider. She is rejected by her mother and she is taken in by this character called Serendipity Wilson, who is a magical character. She is the magical character in the book. She's from the Isle of Man and she is full of stories. So she tells our unnamed narrator, the person who the book is actually about, who becomes the funambulist, the tightrope walker. She tells her all these Manx folk tales and about these creatures on the Isle of Man. And she fills her head and heart with magic.
Was I babbling? I'll try to relax. You're the first person I've spoken to publicly, or privately for that matter, since my, I don't know what to call it, my retirement? That makes me sound old. Since my last performance. Yes, that's a decent description. There have been offers of interviews, appearances and all kinds of things. To be honest, I couldn't face them. But I'm ready now. You came along at the right time. It's not that I care about being out of the public eye, you understand. I'm done with that. I'm babbling again, aren't I? Sorry. Please do go on.
So she becomes a character who kind of believes in magic, but also is very, very, she has her boots in the mire of her own trauma, we could say, and her head in this magical place. And it's about her life. She ends up moving to Coney Island. So that would be probably around the early 70s as she grows up. She ends up moving to Coney Island and becoming the greatest funambulist who ever lived. So she starts off on the what used to be the sideshow circus, sort of the end of that, sort of as things were starting to get a bit sort of nasty and things with gangs in that part of New York, in that part of Brooklyn. But she rises to be the greatest funambulist who has ever lived. And she becomes a star. But through this whole time, she lives with the trauma of having lost a child in the circus when she was a young girl, when she was that young girl full of trauma back in England. And it's that search for that child that takes her to Coney Island. And it's actually the search for the child that gives her this fame, which makes her ambitious enough to rise to become this famous person. So it's a book of stories again. It's layers upon layers of story. It's got folk tales. It's got stories about the circus. It's got stories about different circus characters, but it's also got stories about trauma. So it's quite a deep thoughtful book.
Was the tightrope walking a sort of antithesis for your condition?
Yeah, so I was diagnosed in literally a few months after I started doing my creative writing degree. Now, I come from a theatre background, but the theatre that I did was physical theatre. It had a relationship with circus work, if you like, and I'm a trained clown, trained theatre clown. That's what I was doing in Paris. So there are lots and lots of relationships between the sort of circus theatrical world that she was in and the world that I was coming from. And of course, once I was diagnosed, it was absolutely obvious that I'd never work physically in theatre the way that I had been doing for so many years. So yes, there's definitely a correspondence there. I'm not sure how conscious that always was, but it's definitely there.
And same sort of with Sycorax. She's living with chronic illness, but she becomes the most powerful person on the island.
Absolutely. I have a real need to show people, the world, whoever wants to listen, that unwell people can thrive and live beautifully well, even if you're in pain. No matter what disability you have, you can thrive and live well. You just live with this thing that you have to manage, this disease that you have to manage, this impairment, this disability that you have to manage. And it takes a lot of managing. It does. But you can also thrive and live a beautiful, wonderful life. And it's important to me that my characters, no matter how struck they are with illness or disability, that they are powerful people thriving in their world.
Thanks once again to Nydia Hetherington. That's all we've got time for on today's show. We'll be back at the same time next week. But if you can't wait that long, this and over 450 other episodes of Read On are available to download as a podcast. Just search for RNIB Read On in your favourite podcast app. But remember our daily show, Talking Books, featuring the best the RNIB library has to offer, that we're allowed to play on here. That's every day at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. if you prefer a book at bedtime. The whole schedule is at rnib.org.uk/connect-radio.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.